Good evening, everyone. It is 6:03 p.m., so I will call this meeting of Students Council to order, and we will begin with attendance. Christian Fotang, Pedro Almeida,
here.
Chris Beasley, here. Levi Flamin, Michael Griffiths,
here.
Stephen Rates,
here.
Adrian Lamb,
here.
Mason Peach, Nathan Thiessen,
here.
Muniba Kadir,
here.
Ayman Saif, Amir Mohammed,
here.
Damon Atwood,
here.
Elm Alahi, Precious Majeko Dumni,
present.
Jillian Eisenstadt.
Here.
Noor Abdelwahab.
Here.
Laurel Ford.
Here.
Megan Garbutt. And I am present. Jacob, I believe, is online. And Mark Dumichel is not present. Yeah, please just hang tight. Okay, thank you. So with that, we'll move into the traditional territory acknowledgement reading. Today we have Michael Griffiths reading the acknowledgement. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Christian. So hi folks, my name is Michael Griffiths. I use he, they pronouns, and I am a settler from, and I'm honored and privileged to speak to you on Treaty 6 territory today. The City of Edmonton, the University of Alberta, and the Students' Union occupy land, the stolen land, of the forcibly removed Papachase Cree in Amiskwichiwiskayagan, or Beaver Hills House. From time immemorial, the banks along the river valley have been known as the Pehoan, a meeting place for the Nahiwak, the Nitsapi, Métis, the Nisutlin, Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and others. I also want to acknowledge my home, what I call Coronation, which occupies the traditional territories of the Plains Cree, the Stoney, the Ocheti, Sokoine, Nitsapi, Sutina, Métis, Nihiyawuk, and Cree nations. As a settler, I and others, including the Students' Union and the university, have benefited directly from the historic and ongoing dispossession of Indigenous peoples from their lands. I have a personal responsibility to research and learn from the histories and teachings of First Peoples of Canada. I have the responsibility to seek the restitution of this land and its resources, and I have the responsibility to reflect on and uplift First Nations, Inuit, and Métis voices. As I reflect on my own relationship with the land and the Indigenous people in my life, I call on others to do the same. It is essential that when we speak to do this work in a good way, we are uplifting Indigenous voices and the voices of the whole people. I ask others to critically reflect on how they can strengthen the resistance and resurgence of Indigenous people and the communities they work and live in. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for your acknowledgement. So we will move to the oath reminder for today. Our council oath says, "I will oppose ideas and not people." And I just wanted to give this reminder specifically today because we'll be receiving some content matter surrounding campus security, which can be a tough issue to kind of grapple with and engage with. So I encourage you all to remember that aspect of the oath as we move forward today. Moving to speaker's business, I actually have no speaker's business today. I think that might be a first, but I just wanted to say that I hope the start of all of your semesters are going well, and I'm excited to start the work of our second council trimester. Our next item of business is the consent agenda, which today only includes the votes and proceedings from our last meeting on September 12th. Are there any objections, comments, questions, concerns regarding the consent agenda as presented? Okay, seeing none, the consent agenda is approved as presented, and we will move to the next section of business, which is presentations. Our first presentation is from Chris Hackett and is on the Academic Integrity Policy Suite. Before we proceed with that presentation, I just want to confirm there are no objections to that presentation. Okay, seeing none, Pedro, would you like to introduce?
Hi, everybody. So Chris is here to present on the incoming Academic Integrity Policy Suite. So Chris will touch more on this, but essentially when last year the non-academic portions of the Code of Student Behavior got redone, this left work to be done to replace and redo the academic portions of the Code of Student Behavior. And as such, Chris's team has been working two work teams have been working pretty hard at making a new academic integrity policy and accompanying documents. And the purpose of the presentation today, and I mentioned this in a message to the group before, is because the policy is currently in the consultation phase, seeking feedback for revisions before the final draft undergo the governance approval procedure at the next term. And so while getting presentation allows us to understand the process, the really important point is for us to be able to provide feedback from the student perspective, for that to be taken back with Chris back to SCPC and as necessary to make any necessary changes for this policy to really encapsulate students' needs. And with that, I will pass it on to Chris.
Sure. Sorry, Chris, before you go ahead, we'll just put your slides up for you. Is that all right?
Remember what I said? Yeah,
Yeah.
please.
Yeah, okay.
That would be great.
Um,
right. Yeah, because this had the, I sent along the document I made, which was
cool.
in a PowerPoint.
Awesome.
Just to show, I think basically I was trying to illustrate the new processes versus the old.
Sure.
Sorry.
If you want to and tell me to scroll.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
You have an initial 20 minutes. We can look at extending if you need it. And please just use your mic, but
Yeah.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Got it. I've been engaging in things in this room for 33 years. You'd think I'd know how it works by now. So I'm not gonna, I'm actually not gonna, I'm gonna try not to use that time because I'm here to hear from you as much as possible to draw attention to things. As I said to Pedro before, just because I'm coming here now doesn't mean this is the only opportunity to speak. If you think of something later on, I want to try and create as many opportunities for engagement for the entire community that I can over the next few months that we've got already scheduled for the approval process next term. The Dean of Students and I have asked specifically to give ourselves a lot of time and space for people to consult. And as Pedro said, a lot of people have been putting a lot of work into this. And I really want to highlight the work, particularly that Gerling Carr last year and Pedro has done. They have contributed significantly to this document. This was a fascinating working group to engage with. We were coming in and not with a here's a problem, go figure it out, but how could we do something that we knew was better than what we had done before? We have an opportunity that hasn't come along in a long time. And everybody in that group had knew that what we have had in place is not what we would have picked to do it. So the Code of Student Behavior has been in place since the late 1990s, and it has been tweaked off and on, but it's very much a sort of what I always refer to as a crime and punishment model. It's all about this person. We're looking for people who have violated rules, and then we're going to punish them, and that's all we need to do because everybody else is fine. And so we set out with a goal to how do we look at this in a way. The academic integrity is important to all of us. That how we the degrees that people get, the grades that people get, they're all essentially protected if we engage this properly. It affects research, it affects the way that people engage each other on this campus. So it's important, but we could do a lot better job of doing it. And we wanted to start from a process of the idea that we are a community, all of us, and with lots of communities within it as well. And so how could we change the dynamic so that it's not that simple? Okay, whoever you are, you're all sort of an average student. We find out something's been done, we punish it, and then move on with significant consequences for people and not necessarily fully addressing the problems that we were setting out to do. So in this policy suite, what we did is we began laying out an idea that what we need to do is to have an additional set of processes at the faculty level. So if a professor, instructor in a course identifies a concern, then the faculty should be looking at this and deciding, do we need to do a process, look at whether there's been a violation, got a punishment, or could we look at this as an educational opportunity, something both educational, and we've been talking using the term non-adjudicative, so educational or restorative or any number of other relational kinds of conduct processes that would help the student to understand why is it that we're concerned about this, help them to understand, give them skills so that they can avoid getting in trouble in the future. If they don't ever, if they never engage this process again, they graduate, we get rid of the record. And so they can go through the rest of their academic career and saying, no, I've never been found to violate. Because one of the things that's driven me crazy in my job is even the mildest of sanctions can create significant limitations for students applying for medical school, law school, and all kinds of programs. Something that I hope we do something about that, but we have no control over the entire world of those things. So when you're reading this draft, you'll see a large amount of verbiage that still looks at, oh, here's rules and here's what happens when the rules are violated, et cetera. That because those processes tend to take up a lot of space and they tend to be ones in which we set out structurally how somebody is going to make a decision, what's going to happen, what's the next phase of it. But I'm hoping, and one of the things that Pedro and I've discussed and Darlene and I discussed and everybody in on that group is that we will wind up using the vast majority of the time these new processes rather than reverting back to those. Those will still be in place because we do have to protect the integrity of our processes. We'll have, if everything works the way I wanted to, more transparency in the system. We'll be able to see what's happening, what's not happening in the way that we haven't been able to do before, so that problems that may be developing will be able to deal with them systemically in ways that we just haven't before. So actually, maybe if we could scroll down here a bit. So what I wanted to do, this is the current process under the Code of Student Behavior. So, and we put in TA notifies instructor, because that's typically the way that most of the cases run. It's not always the case, but the teaching assistant sees something in a paper or sees something while somebody's writing an exam or whatever it is. They go to the instructor and the code, the instructor is, sorry, I'm waving my hands about, so I'm hitting the microphone. The instructor is responsible for what happens in the course. Their job was to meet with the student and say what their concern is, but they don't make any decisions. They send it on to the faculty. They submits a report to the dean and the dean's designate, which is what it always is. There have been instances where deans do this themselves, but it's almost always been an associate dean. It's typically in the past, this was an associate dean who also had a number of other responsibilities, and some of the bigger faculties, they would be overwhelmed with huge amounts of cases. They would make a decision. They find a finding whether the student violated or not. If they had a limited authority to impose sanctions, so things that affected the course itself, that's where the dotted line comes in. So if it stayed within their authority, we'd go on to the University Appeal Board, which is the final. And if they thought a student should be suspended or expelled or degree rescinded, then it comes to my office, and this is the title we're about to get rid of once and for all: discipline officer. It's been there. My office used to be called the discipline office. And if you can imagine getting an email saying you need to come and see the discipline officer in the discipline office and how terrifying that would be, this will be the last instance of it. So again, meet with the student, make a decision, send it on, potentially either the faculty or the student can appeal. So we can go on to what we're hoping to see happen. Sorry, scrolling down. So this is the first, I have to break this up into two screens because it gets too complicated now. So again, the instructor identifies the concern and refers to the dean. And so we cut out that initial meeting partly because, so I spent 5 years working in ombuds. I went to a lot of those meetings. The student was terrified. The instructor was terrified. They did almost nothing for either one of them. They gave very little. But the valuable piece of it was that the student would know what the concern was. So what we built into the procedure now is that the dean is responsible for making sure that the student knows before they go. This took some of the burden off the instructor. It took burden off the students because now they've got to go to another. We wanted to reduce the number of meetings they went to. Particularly, we didn't see this one as particularly important. But what we wanted to do as well is give the instructor the opportunity to recommend a process. And so they could say, I've worked with a student. I believe they didn't really know what they were doing. And then, so I think, an educational thing or a non-adjudicative thing, something. And they could say whether they want to be involved in it or not. And I'm hoping we'll see a lot of professors say, I needed to let you know, because that's what the process is. But I'd be happy to sit down with the student and explain the impact of what they did and why we need to do something on it and help make sure they know what those things are. We'll have things in place if they don't want to. But I'm convinced one of the reasons we've always struggled, as most universities struggle, with getting cases into the system is professors aren't any keener than anyone else is on punishing people. And they're worried about consequences for students when they send it in. And so we wound up creating this gray zone where only some people do and some students get doped in some ways. And now this process should give us lots and lots of ability to create a process that works for that student and that circumstance. So the decision at that point, the dean has to decide, are we going to go with the non-disciplinary accountability options, educational or whatever, or through the discipline process? And so what we've done is certainly the current process says if they send it to the disciplinary process, it has to go to somebody else who's been designated by the dean. So the student can come in and be as candid as they can be. Yes, I did this. And here's why. Here's what's happening. And then if it goes to a disciplinary process, they need to be able to make a decision about what they're going to say in that context, because now a different one. If we go to the next part. So this is the discipline process, basically. Forgot what I was going to say about that. This is the non-disciplinary accountability process. So the dean would sit down with the student. And again, we're talking about deans designate. There may be multiple people on a faculty. There will be multiple people on a faculty who might do it. They sit down with the student and work out, what do you need? And then what we're going to do about, they set out is we're going to be building resources that they can refer students to. We're going to hopefully, I've got models from other universities that we can use to train people who might sit down with a student, help them to understand particularly impacts. So accountability, but in a different way. And again, as I said earlier, no further violations. Student graduates, we just get rid of the record. If the student doesn't follow through in an expectation, then the case would go into the discipline process at that time. It's not on this chart, but we did also build an appeal process here. If they want to challenge it, no, I did do it, and what I did was satisfactory, it can be referred to my office, and one of the student conduct officers would take a look and say, oh, yes, they did or didn't. But then it would go through the discipline process. So, yeah, sorry, if you could go to that last screen. So this is what the discipline process would look like. And it looks very similar to what we had in place before, in terms of how it works. And again, we kept in that idea that if a severe sanction is warranted, suspension, expulsion, that it would continue. Except now we're using the new title of student conduct officer because it's way less scary, so that we have multiple levels of oversight in doing it. And then records would be retained, as it says, as per the retention schedules. But we'll have one discipline record that covers the entire university, not different files all over the place. We have an electronic records that will be accessible to whatever decision maker is working on the case. And we can see overall how that student was dealt with. So it's probably more detailed than you really wanted to hear, but I thought, to me, this is critically important to changing the way that we engage. The educational non-adjudicative piece means that we can look, we have people from many cultures on this campus and many backgrounds in education. We can do all kinds of things differently to meet it. We have different needs and different faculties. And I think we want to do is unleash creativity for both the faculty and the students in this. How do we get to a place where somebody, for whatever reason, has done something that we have a problem with, but we want them to be able to move on with their careers and not create more barriers for them being successful. So I will stop talking at this point. Sorry, once I get wound up, this is really something I'm very passionate about. But I've been enjoying, I mean, I know people don't usually enjoy the process where you go out and do all these things, but I actually do, because I think this is incredibly important about who we are as a community. Even just the fact we're talking about this is important, let alone the fact that we're shaping a new policy.
Okay, thank you, Chris, for your presentation. Are there any members of council wanting to ask questions or make statements? Just raise your placards. Damon, please go ahead.
Hi, Chris. I was in the GFC caucus meeting when you presented on a lot of this before. So some of this might not be new to you, but I just had a few quick questions that arose, and I'll just give them, you know, my comments to you, and then you have an opportunity to respond here. Mm-hmm. One of the first things I noticed is that just in terms of sanctions, the imposition of an order or a sanction requiring a written letter of apology. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're forced to write a letter of apology, it has no meaning anyways. Right. So I just wonder about the, you know, is that really a worthwhile sanction to include? But that's just a minor critique. But the more important thing that I'm curious about is something that you had said during a previous meeting was about the data that's collected through this process and the usage of it. And we had talked a little bit about collecting data on, you know, who's involved in these types of allegations, what the outcome was, and that this data could help enhance or optimize future uses of this policy, essentially. Mm-hmm. But one thing we didn't talk about was just my concern is just the improper use of that data, and whether or not that needs to be specifically articulated in this policy, specifically if it were the case that a minority group or, you know, any group was, you know, found to be engaging in more conduct of a certain type than another, you know, certain bad actors can make a lot of hay out of that. Mm-hmm. When it doesn't necessarily statistically mean anything. So that's just one of my concerns. And then the final concern I'll just pass on to you is just that I noticed that the appeal policy says that there's no further right of appeal because the board is delegated, but I just wonder about that wording, because technically it could theoretically be subject to judicial review. So I just wonder if by saying that we're misleading students.
Yeah. If I can, let me just make a note to myself to remember to talk about that. So let me go through those in order here. I know exactly what you're talking about, the letter of apology. The way we've used it is the exercise is the valuable piece. So historically, my office has used it. It was under the context of conduct probation. And it's not necessarily an apology that's gone to anyone. It's it is the exercise of doing it and then working with the decision maker. And so we may ask, say, you know, you need to do this because we want you to engage in a process of thinking about the impact of your behavior. Almost always an apology is going to be in non-adjudicative process. It's something that somebody wants to engage in. Even then, I would be cautious about mandating it, and we're going to send it. No, nothing automatically goes to anybody. I'm open to fiddling with the language and talking about it. The intent is not to put it in a place. One of the things I've been learning in this process is that frequently when people have concerns, it's because we haven't been clear enough in doing it. So I'll make a note of that. I'm happy to talk about it, but that's what we intended it to be. Something that encourages, because it wasn't mentioned at all as a possibility in the past, it's not something that was widely used. So let me make a note of that I'll take away, because I think we might be able to do something with it, because I would like decision makers to think about, even when we're going through a punitive process, you can do things that help a student to learn from it rather than whacking them. The second part, the data piece. I acknowledge your concern 100%. There are twin sets of problems here. One, we know that there are groups and areas. One of the things, so I've been working in conduct in one form or another, apart from the life I've spent in academia beforehand in other ways, but with ombuds and in my current position for about 18 years now, and all the way through, it's blazingly obvious we have a problem. And we don't talk about it. And we don't talk about it for exactly the reason you said. Well, wait a minute, somebody is going to, we have far more international students in our system than you would expect for their population. And it's not because they're all out there cheating. It's because there are all kinds of other issues. So I was talking to Lula Adams, who's our DEI advisor for the Dean of Students today. And one of the things we talked about is we need to change the way we think about this. When we identify these things, it's not about finding, oh, we've got a bad group of people. It's here's an area where the university is failing. We are at fault here, and we need to find a way to engage them better. And my concern, there's a legitimate issue here that we got to grapple with still about being careful about sharing of data. This isn't done yet. But we have to be careful not to avoid this discussion because somebody might misuse it, because that perpetuates the same problem. It's been happening for 18 years now, and we haven't done anything about it. And partly it's because we're just afraid. And I will challenge us to find us another way of addressing it that takes into account it's happening. And it's not happening because anybody in this process is evil. It's happening because we're not doing enough to engage in education up front, and we don't have processes that really work well for teaching things when people get identified. We treat every student as if they're equally. We assume that they all came in perfectly formed. I think there's lots of issues with domestic students that we don't see, that we aren't necessarily catching. One of the biggest reasons when international students are overrepresented that I'm convinced of is it's easier to get caught when English is not your first language. That's perpetuates one of the biggest problems in that system. So I take your point. And I think we should talk about this a lot more, but I don't think the solution is to not talk about that, the elephant in the room there. And there are other elephants in the room. We're not engaging because we're not looking at this. Judicial review. I remember you were in law school. That's right. So yeah, I'm happy to talk about this all day. When that line is about what our internal procedures are, there are many ways of challenging things that exist outside of the university, which we can't contemplate. Rather than putting it in the policy that it would be in supporting documents, we have to be careful about giving students advice about what they can do or not do to us. Again, going back to my ombuds days, and certainly absolutely true in my current job, I could never give a student advice about what they would do outside of the university because I have an inherent interest in the university. So everything I did would be to some extent biased. So we need to make sure that students are aware, have access to things to groups and information where they can challenge us, because those places exist for that reason, whether it's human rights complaints or judicial review. I've never been afraid of judicial review.
I think it's just the wording says no further ground of appeal to any other body is what it says. So just specifying that's within the university.
Yeah, we could do that. I want to be really careful because, as I say, I think that there's a lot of ways you can challenge us. Judicial review is the obvious one. And there are frequently cases I've seen over the years where I thought, somebody could have taken us human rights. They could have done other things, but they didn't think of it. They didn't know about it.
Okay, thank you. I do see we have three more members on the speakers list, but we have exhausted the time. So I'd look for a motion to extend. I see Chris and Nathan. So it'd be to extend by 10 minutes. Are there any objections to an extension of 10 minutes? Okay, seeing no objections, we're extended by 10. And Jill, please go ahead.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for the presentation. It seems like for the most part, this policy is pretty student-focused, which I appreciate, and the fact that you're bringing it to us for consultation is really important. So I'm the counselor de la Faculté Saint-Jean. So my sort of preoccupation is making sure that this process is from start to end possible for students whose first language is French, because we're a bilingual campus. So from what I'm understanding, most of this these conversations are happening, you know, between the dean and the student. Hopefully it's resolved through their exercises. So those are things that can be done in French. It's just until they get to, you know, the student conduct officer, faculty decision makers, and then the student misconduct appeal panel. Are there any like current requirements or intentions of making sure that there are some that are things available for students to be able to express themselves in French and be able to go through this process to the end in the language that they're most comfortable with while they're advocating for themselves?
So we've had a number of discussions about this, and Pedro has been very passionately discussing it. And I'm very much open to the idea. So one of the things, it's not in the current draft, but it raised the question about not only about Campus Saint-Jean, but are there other groups on CAP. So this is part of the consultation process I'm doing now. It's on my list of things to do is to connect with CSJ, both with the administration, but also with the students, talk about this. So I think the key piece of this, we would have difficulty right now doing this at the student conduct officer level. I want to look at the potential for an appeal. So the new appeal is designed as a appeal on the record. So so something where we may be able to, I've got a meeting arranged, but I haven't done it yet with the appeals coordinator and governance. So what would the implications, can they access enough people who would be able to read French fluently enough that they would be able to pick up nuance in this? My concerns I raised with Pedro on this before, and that's why I'm being cautious with it, is I don't want CSJ students to be put in a position where they have to trade rights for rights. And if we're going to go in and say there has to be French speaking appeal panel, do we have enough access that they can leave the CSJ to have that decision reviewed? So it's not just, my concern would be that a chair from CSJ might on the appeal might be somebody who reports to the person who made the decision, and therefore we're looking at not, and they maybe have all the attention in the world. We've got to make sure that CSJ students, when they're challenging it, get the same rights that every other student get. And so, I was trying not to be long-winded, but sorry, it's inherently who I am. I'll just say that's an important point, and we're going to look at it. But I am open to also, are there other things that we need to do with this appeal process or the entire process for other groups on this campus too that we haven't thought of?
Thank you. Chris, please go ahead.
Yes, I kind of, hi Chris.
Please use your mic though.
Hi Chris. So I have kind of a question and then a comment. So the first question, I'll do the comment first. The comment is just whether there's any consideration for like a justification clause for like reports of academic misconduct that come well after the actual like incident has happened. Yeah. So if someone comes up 8-9 months later, the student has done something.
Yeah.
Just because that always, like, I think generally tends to raise a red flag, especially since we're quite reliant on the individual judgments of TAs or professors. So just kind of speaking through your thought process on that. And then the other angle is, so I know we talked about the records being expunged at the end of program, but what about students who leave the program early? Say they apply for med school or law school mid-program for entry, and what happens there?
I have to think back. We have those circumstances already in place. And so when I talk about the end of program, there's a way of determining all of that. It's not something we're looking for a loophole so we can hang on to this stuff. And it's already, so right now when I do conduct probation, for example, we always use the end of program. So if student changes to another program, their conduct probation is over. Don't tell everybody that, because we'd like them not to reoffend. But yeah. So, you know, again, that may be something we need to be a little clearer about. It's also something, as I said, this is going to be one set of records for all. So we're already working with the records management and information privacy office about how do we manage this all the way through. And sorry, the first thing that you said was
justification clause for
justification clause for
if a professor
submits the timing thing. That's another question that was put on the radar at the end of some of the process, and we're going back and forth on it. Something we take seriously. So the way that this is structured right now, it's not just for things that happen in class. So it also incorporates, we tried to make it more logically inclusive of the research and scholarship conduct policy, which applies to students as well. So something might happen in presenting a paper at a conference, for example, or other kinds of things. So that might, those are things that might come up later that we didn't know about. The expectation is that so we put a general framing in right now that this has to be dealt with as timely a fashion as possible. So a TA shows up 8 months afterwards, that case isn't going forward. Same thing. And again, I think that we wanted to find a way to capture that, those things that might come in later, but also what's reasonable. So a professor goes, oh, wait a minute, I forgot last year I had a case and I didn't send it in. That shouldn't be coming in. There is a fundamental fairness issue with people being addressed as soon as we know about something so that they have the most ability to defend themselves. The longer you leave it, the, you know, people's memories fade. Somebody is sitting on something so that they can say, which frankly doesn't happen often, but it could. They get an unfair advantage that the student is not, and it's not something we wanted. So everybody would be required to justify the timeliness of a case. And it would be something that could be looked at in an appeal and go like, no, they didn't have, this was not appropriate. I think we still are going to have to work on that language to clear it up. So before we go, come back, you've touched on a number of things that we're still going to be playing around with before the final draft comes in.
Thank you. Stephen, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Chris, for your presentation today. One thing that's coming to mind for myself is just how this works across the university. And I think like the one change that's been experienced across the university, Adrian, could you move your head so I can see Chris? Yeah. The one thing, you don't have to duck like that, but just like, you know, the restructuring has resulted in a kind of centralization of a lot of services, but I kind of perceive that there's almost a central or a decentralization here. Like the dean is able to have more decision-making power and a little bit more influence and involvement in especially the non-disciplinary process. So I'm just wondering if you can audit that statement just to help me understand. And then additionally, you know, if it is a decentralization or it shifts in that direction, or just more largely, if the dean's role is changing, what is, have we had an eye towards like resourcing and implementing this change already? I understand that policy is policy and that's supposed to right. set out how we go about things and implementation is like actually doing it, but just wondering if we've matched what we are striving to achieve by setting in policy, what is manageable from a resourcing perspective.
So from my perspective, we actually haven't changed. This is the same structure in terms of faculties that we have on the code of student behavior. It's the dean or designate who makes decisions. What we have, you're right, the university's restructured. We now have resources we didn't have before to support those decision makers. So the faculties that are in colleges and the departments of education have multiple people now who are dedicated to providing supports for people who are making decisions in those faculties. They're already, I'm meeting with the directors next week. One was involved in the drafting of the policy, but they're already gearing up for this. How they're getting training in doing restorative and other kinds of processes. They're engaging with us about how do we build these kind of educational tools? How do we train decision makers? They will be assigning and managing cases. The decisions will be made by dean's designate, because the dean's designate means that we're reflecting the academic structure of the university, that the idea is that every faculty is to some extent different. And there may be unique ways of approaching or unique concerns in those things that need to be taken into account. It's why we have the university-wide structures that go in for this, the really significant sanctions, and then the challenge part at the top. So all of that happened. So what we tried to do was to reinforce the idea that we have multiple cultures throughout this university, but make sure that they have more resources than they had in the past for doing this. As I said, this was always something that was done off the side of desk by somebody who was already really busy, and there was no training involved. We're building substantial training. This policy has a requirement that they get trained, which we didn't have before.
Thank you. So that brings us to the end of the 10-minute extension. Is there appetite for a further? We do have two more members on the speakers list. I see Nathan and Adrian. Is there any opposition to a further 10-minute extension? Okay, seeing none, we're extended for a further 10 minutes. And Damon, please go ahead.
I just wanted to flag just one other concern that came to me while I was reviewing this policy. Specifically, one of the grounds for appeal is where the sanction that's imposed is outside of a reasonable range. Presumably, you'll produce some sort of document that gives a reasonable range, be my guess. But one of the key tenets of the decisions of administrative decision makers, like we would see here, is a general consistency. Mm-hmm. But that kind of, the importance of that is kind of undercut when you don't actually have anything to compare it to. So I'm just wondering if there's an appetite or an ability, whether we formalize it in here would be my preference, but the disclosure of, you know, this is the type of academic conduct that was alleged. This is the type of sanction that was imposed. Yeah. Because otherwise, I mean, how do you appeal something by saying that it's not within the, you know, it's not within the realm of normal when you don't ever know what normal is?
Yeah.
And so I think it just, anyway, just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The plan is to build documents we've never had before in for decision makers and for students going into a process so they can see this is, they will never have you do this, you get that. That's federal discretion, that won't work. And it tends to produce really harsh sanctions because you're targeting sanctions for the worst things as opposed to what most people do. But there'll be guidelines, so you should be able to recognize, is this something reasonably within that range of things we might expect, given all the factors that play with this particular student? I would be totally open to doing, I argued for that years ago, that we should be producing reports that we remove all identifying information and go, this is what we've been dealing with. This is the kind of outcomes that we've seen. And we do obviously really generically do that. I don't know that I could sell it, but you and I could be happily take us on with people and make an art case for it. There's a lot of challenges, a lot of concerns that people have for the same reasons that you talked about before with these statistics. Is it going to reveal too much information about people? But I think we spent too many years with decisions being done in the dark. So I guess I can say I'm totally in support of it, but I'm not sure I'd be able to get it in.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any final statements or questions before we moved to Pedro to wrap up? Okay, seeing no more, Pedro, please go ahead.
Thank you, Christian. Yeah, I would just like to thank everybody for their engagement with this. And to thank Chris for coming in to present. And also to thank Chris for planning alongside me, like, really extensive consultation pathway for students. Chris has presented to our GFC Student Council, GFC Student Caucus, which is just an unofficial collective of all the GFC undergraduate members, as well as Chris is coming to the Council of Faculty Associations. We're planning to come to Council of Faculty. We're planning to have Chris come to Council of Faculty Association in October. So very appreciative of that. Where Chris and I are in a lot of conversations, as he mentioned, about this, which is why I left it up mostly for everybody else to get their opinions on. And but in addition, if you'd like to kind of read some of the stuff that I have thought about the policy as well, this incredibly student-focused policy, but just the couple of additions that Chris and I have talked about extensively, like the potential for more inclusivity for CSJ students, as mentioned earlier, they're included in the report, my executive report at the end. But overall, I just really want to thank Chris for not only doing the work necessary here, but coming to talk to students about something that is supposed to be extremely student focused. So yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chris. Okay, so with that, we move to our next presentation, which is from the, and correct me if I get this wrong, but the University of Alberta Safety and Security Committee on campus security. Before we proceed, are there any oppositions to this presentation? Okay, seeing none, Michael, would you like to introduce?
Absolutely. Thank you, Christian. So, hey, folks, we have James and Yvonne here on the far side, as well as folks from our community assistance team, one of our community assistance teams, here to discuss, along with myself, a little bit about campus security today. You can find the slides starting on page 67 of your order papers with two additional slides on the late editions. We thought it would be great to bring this presentation to council as part of a broader kind of stakeholder engagement initiative that the security committee is working on. It's really important for us to gather perspective from across campus. Safety and security touches on pretty much every element of campus. So student council and consulting students is one really important element to gain consultation and engagement on the direction that we need to be going, but also providing updates on what is being done already and kind of the current state of campus security. So I will be helping James out for the presentation, but with that, I can pass it to James.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. I'm so happy to be here. If we could go to the next slide, that'd be appreciated. And Michael introduced Yvonne, who's also on the Safety and Security Committee with us, and that's a rather large and comprehensive group, I believe, that helps look at campus security. And I'm going to highlight campus security as it relates to the overall safety aspect of the culture of care that the institution has been working hard on. But before that, Yvonne is my strategic initiatives officer, and I'll call her my my valued lieutenant that's helping us along with a couple of others in the engagement plan. So really driving not just where we've been, where we want to go, but what have we missed? Who else can we engage with? How can we engage with them more effectively so that we really create a sense of we and a collective buy-in of the shared responsibility of how we can all keep each other safe, not just as individuals, but as a community. So I'm going to touch a little bit more on the you ask. Then we'll talk about the environment. Hopefully you have not had any unpleasant experiences, but we do have members of our community that have had unpleasant experiences on some of our campuses or quite often in the transit system, of which we will touch on in terms of how we're working with Edmonton Transit Services to try and make things better. But our focus in the committee is on public safety and security. And I want to differentiate that from the OH&S aspects of operating a lab as a grad student or those kinds of things, ensuring people have the appropriate training or protective equipment. There is an overlap. And the overlap with the OH&S safety that we're really focused on the culture of care is, I'll call it psychological safety and making sure that people feel safe in their work environment, of which I think we can all agree that public safety and security, your individual and collective security, is a key aspect of that. So definitely some strong connections there. Next slide. So I'm assuming a lot of people have read this, but this has been a standing committee now for a number of years. And really we've built upon it, added to its membership to ensure that we have identified and bought into champions that can help us engage and spread the word, as well as identify where things may not be going as well as we want them to be going. And hence that committee comes together on a monthly basis and looks at our actions. And then we have a number of things where people can populate as we go along. And ultimately, if there's something that's unsafe that needs immediate action, in my portfolio, of course, I have protective services. I have all of the educational buildings other than parkades and residences, but I work closely with my colleague for parking services and residents, because of course we're all together in this. So I do believe it's a holistic and integrated approach, not just looking at things like protective services, but looking at all of the actions that we can take to make our campuses safer. Next slide, please. So for those that have been around for a while, I think you can see and we have felt through what's happening in our downtown core, there has been a noticeable increase and a perception and real lack of security in certain parts of downtown, and particularly the transit systems. And I would highlight that as it's getting colder. Sometimes that gets amplified by members of our disadvantaged or vulnerable community that fundamentally, you know what, are just trying to survive. They're in difficult situations. And, you know, we will touch on the community assistance team in a bit, and I'll get them to introduce themselves as we get down. But it's something I'm very proud of. We refer to it as outreach, but it's really looking at how we've built that experience and that capacity to help members on a volunteer basis get assistance that or services that they need. That's challenging. And maybe if you have an open appetite, we can have the team share some examples of the challenges and successes that they've had and how they work with their colleagues throughout the city in trying to address what are significant gaps in the social services system that are going to take many years to, I'll think, rectify with persistent investment and attention. We've identified that, you know, there have been increases, particularly on North Campus, Enterprise Square, for the most part, and we refer to trespassing and suspicious activity. I just want to describe those a little bit. When we talk about suspicious activity, it's almost a gut feeling that when you see something happening that you go, that doesn't feel right, it doesn't look right. It could be someone's engaged in criminal activity, or someone looks like they are having a lot of challenges and could potentially pose, I'll call it concerns for our community or make them feel unsafe. Trespassing is when individuals who have been formally trespassed from our campuses for good reasons find them back on our campuses for a multitude of reasons. Some of that could be criminal activity for a multitude of reasons, survival, or there are people who are engaged in predatory activities to capitalize not just on our community, leaving things out, but on the vulnerable community. So within that community, there's a significant complexity that we need to understand as we try to work through this together. We do keep track of reported incidents, known incidents, and that's available on the Protective Services website. And you can see that we have 10 locations that, for the most part, are in close proximity to LRT and transit. And by de facto, we end up with more of those types of incidents in those locations. Next slide, please. So I want to talk about making our campuses safer together. And it is an ongoing initiative that we hope to continue learning from our community through these engagements, through our experience about what's working, what's not working, what we can do better. But you can see that this is not a stranger individual phenomenon. It's everyone. It's our third-party contractors, our faculty, our staff, our visitors, people who are here want to feel safe. And each one of those groups often likes to be communicated with in a different way. And they often have a very different perception around security and safety and what constitutes that. So I do want to acknowledge that we are attuned to the various perceptions of how our actions or what's happening on our campus can impact people differently. You know, reporting an emergency situation. One of the things that, you know, I pointed out today as I was engaging one of our faculties around research and building incidents or failures in equipment is in order to do something about it, we need to know about it. So therefore, really making sure our community knows who to call in what circumstance is critical. And our team has been, I think, starting to get that word out. I know that a lot of new students are overwhelmed with just coming on board, just trying to find out where they're going. So trying to engage with Michael, with others, so that we're feeding the right types of information through the right forms, so that should something happen, should a situation arise, people know who to call. And we have these lovely little pamphlets that we'll hand some out. We've got thousands more being printed. And I'm always looking for ways to make sure that people have this at their fingertips. So, you know, Michael is your representative on the Safety and Security Committee and has an active and fruitful voice. And we often look to him to say, what do the students think? What will work with our students and what may not work? And of course, ETS, who we had here during the week of welcome with some of the stands trying to convey what are they doing and what are they going to be doing in the future. So again, the more that gets out, I think the better equipped our community will be in responding to something that can be quite alarming. And I want to share some examples that I have received personally from students as they exit or are working their way through the transit system and are stepping over an individual who is homeless and near death because they're ODing. I'll save the additional details, but that this person watched hundreds of people step over that individual to get to the door. And although it sounds like I'm being, you know, critiquing of that, everyone's got different comfort levels about what they can and should do. And what I'm hoping is that through these engagements, through awareness building, through education, that more and more people are willing to go a little further. Demonstrate perhaps a little bit of extra courage and make a phone call to potentially save someone's life. I'm definitely not suggesting you intervene or, you know, you run and administer Naloxone, though that training is available for the Dean of Students. The more and more we can engage our community, the more empathetic and aware they are and equipped they are, the better it's going to be for everyone, if that makes sense. Next slide, please. So I think I've touched on transit safety, and fortuitously, we had a supervisor from ETS do a presentation to the Safety and Security Committee yesterday, talking about what they're doing and how we can work together. That's an ongoing engagement, and certainly as an institution, we're quite large, and we do have the ability to influence within reason what's being done there, make suggestions, as was offered up yesterday. And we do hold regular forums to provide constructive feedback or engage them so that we're aware of what they're doing and we can adapt accordingly. And if we feel it's not enough, we can make helpful suggestions. And you know what? They're looking for our help. They're looking for everybody's help. And the U of A does have a big voice. Next slide. So key stakeholder engagement. This is one of those examples. Yvonne will put up a couple of slides that just gives a bit of a flavor of who we've talked to thus far and who's on the list for the next couple of months. But this needs to be an ongoing, never-ending campaign. As people leave the university and new people come in, whether that's faculty, staff, and students, or third-party contractors. Because one thing I have found is we tend to think that box is checked, only to realize that we have thousands and thousands of new people on our campus that have never heard this. So I think making sure that we have those regular check-ins and are optimizing how we engage, whether it's with the GSA using the various mechanisms of Instagram or Twitter so that people are actually getting that information in a timely way. Communications and marketing. We do have a website that's linked up there that has materials and resources on there. And I would hope that people who view themselves as champions or want to play a serious role in keeping themselves and others safe become familiar with the materials that are on there, such as these things. Some people can take a snapshot on their phone and, you know what, at least have something you can refer to rather than saying, I don't know what to do because I'm in a very stressful situation, which I think is normal for most people. I want to touch on enhanced staffing and outreach. So, we did a study, and it was determined that our protective services team needed some assistance in their staffing levels compared to our other post-secondary institutions across Canada. We were at the lower end in terms of our staffing levels for the size of our campus and our population. So we've mindfully reallocated some funding, as Michael would know, to have some permanent peace officers. But also during the cold months, make sure that in certain locations like those top 10 we talked about, we can bring in either security agents or we can bring in third-party security providers that have a mindful presence to help disseminate information, but also act as eyes and ears when something's not going the way it should or something suspicious is taking place. That, of course, is tied to our building action plan. And I just want to touch on a couple of things because it doesn't just mean improvements to infrastructure like card access or removing access to particular areas where individuals take shelter. And I say that in an empathetic way because I know some of our vulnerable community are just trying to stay warm. But I do want to make the overt statement that as an institution, our commitment and our responsibility and accountability is to make sure that our students, faculty, and staff have a safe environment. And although some of these individuals may not be dangerous, substance abuse is prevalent. And then you get the complexities of mental health issues and all that compounds into they are potentially dangerous sometimes. Therefore, it behooves us to limit access. And we also do that through the reduction of building hours. So we have limited the number of access points and reduced building hours where possible. Michael is actively engaged with my team and the faculties to make sure that the appropriate balance is struck and that students have access to the appropriate spaces at the appropriate times. So I'm quite confident that that's going to move in a very positive direction. And we're cognizant that it's getting dark and it's getting cold. And each one of those things, of course, compounds how we perceive security, which we'll touch on in a little bit. So the campus security survey. Next slide, please. So we did not survey our staff and faculty yet. That will be done late fall, early winter. But we did take the opportunity to conduct a survey with our student body as outlined in that slide and got, a fairly high confidence rating. Next slide. So at a high level, what I take away from this, most of the time, most of our community feels very safe or somewhat safe. But in accordance with other surveys that we have done in the past on this very subject, when it gets dark, and of course, that changes given the time of year and when lighting is poor for a number of reasons, people do not feel as safe. And there was a significant number of individuals, well, students in this case, that with darkness don't feel as safe. That is understood. And I think our actions need to reflect that people feel very different during the day and night and certainly how they access our buildings or move through the buildings rather than outside is a significant factor. Michael, do you have anything to add on that one?
I think James covered most of it. The only thing I would add is that it also changes, again, like James said, based on whether folks are inside or outside of buildings. So like James talked about on the last slide, with the reduction of building hours, the reduction of building hours is really an effort for the James's team to kind of combat the state of security on campus with the little resources that we have, recognizing that we need to keep unaffiliated folks out of our buildings in many cases. But like he said, we don't want this to inhibit students' access. So James and myself are working together on striking that balance, ensuring that through the use of card reader technology and things like that, we can make sure that students still have that access. While also keeping our campus as safe as possible. And this is just going to be especially powerful in making students feel safe when we get to night and winter and things like that, because the survey also indicated that students feel much safer inside.
Absolutely, thank you. Next slide, please. So before we go to this, I would actually like to the community assistance team. So we have three, and we have two different models. We have a model with a peace officer and a navigator, and we have the complementary model of a navigator with our patrol of peace officers that are moving around in their vehicles or on bikes. And you know what? We're comparing those two models and determining if there's a better model or if they are complementary, et cetera. But could I ask you to introduce yourselves? And maybe could we take just a few minutes for them to share what exactly it is they do? Because I can describe it at length, but I bet you they'll do a better job than me.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think before we do that, maybe this is a good time to extend So Levi, Nathan, sorry, I'm just letting our team catch up. So the motion is to extend by 10 minutes. Is there any opposition to an extension? Okay, seeing none, we're extended. And yes, please go ahead, introduce yourselves.
Perfect, thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Josh Dillon, and I am an employee of the Mustard Seed, a nonprofit here in Edmonton. So I work alongside Tracy, and then at nights I work with Patrol. So our main goal is to help community members, vulnerable community members, when they decide that they are ready and wanting resources to help connect them and work to address the lack of basic needs or whatever needs that they may be searching for in that moment. So a lot of the times it's clothing, food, but sometimes we start the process for more complex processes, including identification and then financing and finally housing. We usually will work in one of two scenarios. The first of all being a call to service. So if there is a community member that's on campus somewhere in need of our expertise, we can come and attend that situation, give them what they need, what we have, either food or clothing, and then direct them to the services as appropriate. And then the second, the more long-term, is when there is a community member that is more established. This is more common in forested areas, and then we can work to transition them to different resources, provide them an alternative for housing so that we can keep both the campus safe and deal with them in a manner of dignity.
Thanks, Josh. My name is Tracy. I'm a peace officer with the U of A Protective Services, and Josh and Janelle are my partners, I guess you'd say. So this team was established over a year ago. We joined partnership with the Mustard Seed. Like Josh was saying, we work with people to get to the root of the problem. So a lot of the people that we come across, like Josh was saying, they don't have ID. They don't have the basics. We've got clothing. We've got food hampers that we can hand out. We work with a lot of encampments on the Forest Reserve and South Campus to get people connected to resources. We've had some huge success stories of individuals getting housed, individuals getting identification. That may sound small, but these people are been probably chronic homelessness for about 15, 20 years, their entire life, substance abuse. So a lot of the times we're digging to the root of the problem, gaining trust with that community member and building those relationships, right? So we may come across somebody and talk to them about 10 times, but they're not willing to get that help because it's all consent-based. We're meeting them where they're at. So if it's a pair of shoes they need that day, then we're going to get them a pair of shoes. If it's a jacket because the weather has changed, they're not dressed for the weather, we can help them out with that, right? So it's really walking alongside of the community members. And also not only do we deal with the vulnerable, but we do deal with students as well. So we've had students come into our office to report certain things, where we come out to CSJ where students have landed from different parts of the country and got no money, no resources. So we can connect them to all the resources here on campus, to the appropriate people, whether it's res services, safe house, whatever that may look like.
Hi. I'm Janelle. My name is Janelle Dodd. I'm one of the navigators, and I'm from Bentaro Traditional Healing Society. So, and I'm brand new with the team as of August 11th. As a navigator, my role is focusing on relationship building. So, with individuals that are lacking with relationships within their community. So if they're on campus, they're part of our community. And so engaging them as community members, valued community members, just like anybody else. And everything we do is led by the individuals that we're supporting and walking alongside. And sometimes that, they don't want assistance for whatever reason, and we respect that. But the more times we see them, they usually say, okay, well, maybe these guys are kind of funny usually. I'm kind of funny. So I would say I'm kind of fun to hang out with. but it's a very non-threatening approach. Tracy's in a uniform, Josh and I are not. But we had a community member say today, Tracy's different. She's different. Yeah, she's in a uniform, but she's different. She's very community focused. So we're not out there for enforcement. And our job is to just kind of, you know, let's deal with some of the root issues or not deal with them, but let's get you connected with some supports if that's what you want. And just treat people with dignity, respect, value. Because they're part of our community. So, yeah.
Just to add to that, you know, I'm very passionate about this program. We've had community members come into our front office asking to speak with us. I mean, that's telltelling when you have community members referring to other community members. Go see Tracy and Josh and Janelle, they'll help you. I mean, that's pretty impactful, right? And when a community member comes into the office and they're all cleaned up and they got hosed, I mean, that's very impactful, right? For them to say that you saved my life because I would have been dead on the street somewhere. And just making those connections, I think, is really important. And our patrol officers do a phenomenal job of connecting. They have access to clothing as well, water, food hampers. So all that stuff is available to our patrol members 24/7. So they take the same approach, right? It's just, this is, the partnership is between the Mustard Seed and Bantero. So we try to connect them to those resources. And plus we sit on so many committees outside of the U of A. So we're well aware of what's, Boyle Street was happening, what the changes are happening, what, you know, shelters are open. And the issue on the south side here, there is no 24/7 shelters, right? So everybody downtown doesn't want to go stay downtown. So, you know, it's heartbreaking. We have, when we call, when the winter comes and there's no shelters open, where do you take these people? Like, we take them to a Tim Hortons, get them lunch. And that's where that's at, because there's just not enough beds in our city to accommodate the amount of people that are homeless right now. So, yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Little Dose Reality. And thanks, Tracy, for mentioning the other patrol members, because I'd like to say that they're in uniform too, and they have the same mindset that that you just elicited. Being mindful, being respectful. Sometimes enforcement absolutely is required, but that is not the primary mechanisms that we put up front. It's how do we actually help people? How do we educate and build those relationships? Talking about relationships. So I do work with my colleague, Carrie Smith, who is the Vice Provost of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. And why I put this slide up ties to, I'll give an example, incident in Waterloo, classroom safety. This is going to be an ongoing effort, and really listening circles are beginning to help engage a diverse community, and with the intent of improving awareness, increasing by an understanding empathy of what is a diverse community. So that when something doesn't look right, when it doesn't sound right, when there are telltale signs that something could or is going to happen, people feel confident enough and courageous enough to ask a question or make a phone call and suggest that something doesn't feel right. And really that's the intent here, is to broaden that awareness, increase the buy-in, the empathy, the understanding of what is and always will be a diverse community. Next slide. I think I get to put Yvonne on the spot, because we have two more slides to talk about our engagement plan. And this is her opportunity to speak to what have we done and where are we going? And then, of course, through Michael or any of you, what else can we do? Who else can we engage with? Because certainly I'm quite passionate about this, and I don't think our work will ever be done. I need help. We need help.
Thanks, James. You stole most of what I was supposed to say.
See, no, in a more mindful way than I did.
So as you can see on the screen, this is just a little bit of a visual that we have for the last couple of months that we've engaged with over the last couple of months. As James alluded to, there is a second page of ongoing, which would be the next couple of months. So as you can see, we have quite a few different methods of outreach. We do meetings, we do sessions, we meet with a variety of different people. I'm not sure who knows, but the UASC committee is filled with multiple different representatives. So we do have a lot of different input from that area. And because of that, we have briefing notes, discussions, presentations, outreach. From September, we did do Week of Welcome with UAPS, having their presence there. We do a bunch of digests, so we have our comms team assisting us with the digest for students, staff, faculty. We also have met with the the University of Alberta International Team, Campus Services, SU Council. And then we do have the blog, which will wrap us up to the end of September. And then into the next slide, we do have what we have planned for the next 4 months. As James mentioned, this is ongoing, so it does look a little bare. I acknowledge that. And that's where we're open to people's feedbacks and what we're missing, where else can we go. October does look busy. We are hoping to meet with quite a few different people just because we all know it's getting darker, it's getting colder. But if there is anything missing, by all means, Michael has my information. You guys can reach out. As James mentioned, I am leading the engagement pieces for this committee.
Thanks, Yvonne. You know what, I want to end, and I want to highlight, I should have his name. There is a student in ECA who he must be a security professional because he puts together comprehensive reports on how the system is working, whether that's our measures, and he works with my facility service partner in ECA. And I'm actually thinking about reaching out and saying, would you like a job? Because that individual is engaged 100% on how do we make that building safer. So I think I'll talk to Michael about that person. But what I'm hoping we do here is not necessarily creating another one of them, because it's almost too much, though greatly appreciated, but creating buy-in and engagement and awareness so that you feel you have a voice. And when something doesn't look right or something's not working, you're able to communicate that with my team, with Michael via the Safety and Security Committee, and we're able to act quickly to address real bona fide concerns. So with that, you know what, let's just keep going. And if there's an appetite for questions or discussion, then let's do it.
Okay, thank you very much. I just want to see, is there an appetite for any questions or discussion or statement? Okay. In that case, we are out of that 10 minutes, so I'd look favorably upon a motion to extend. I see Adrian and Nathan. Is there any opposition to extending for a further 10 minutes? Okay, seeing none, we're so extended. And I think I saw Damon's placard first, so please go ahead.
First of all, thanks for, to everybody involved in security on campus. It's an important job. And I think sometimes we can take it for granted when things go as they should. As a counselor for the law, the Faculty of Law, as identified in your presentation there, that's one of the locations where a lot of stuff happens to occur. I have noticed a change from this year compared to the previous year, just in terms of some of the initiatives that the Law Center undertook last year. So that's good in terms of restricted access, a few other little odds and ends. But one of the questions I had for you is, one of the main concerns that I recall from last year is that nobody really knew how to get in touch with protective services or security. And I wonder if, being that dispatch for protective services, it's not an emergency response service for the most part. That's 911. So when you're talking to people, presumably it's not a crisis state. So I wonder if there's any appetite to open up, first of all, combining all these different, there's a different number for Augustana, there's a different number for, for here, combining all these numbers into one, but then also entertaining the idea of receiving text messages or creating a 6-digit short code that can receive text. That's a lot easier. I just think that would open up communication because, even me, and when I tried to call security because there was some fire going on, I had to look it up on Google, what's the number? The place wasn't burning down, don't worry, but it's just hard to find your number. That's all I can say about that.
It's a great question. It's an ongoing challenge, which is, this is one tool, which is a pretty small pamphlet, but that's where looking to Michael and others. I like the idea around text. We're looking at that for a number of different systems and how we communicate, but 911 is for emergencies. And at the same time, we do ask people to let the protective services know because they're engaged during the day. We have a police officer on campus, which we're very fortunate. So we have that liaison and that immediate knowledge and connection with EPS. And through my control center, we have with the fire department. That's the kind of recommendation we're looking for, is what might work and then what's possible.
So what I would suggest with regards to different numbers is they're different service providers. So if we're talking about Augustana, there's a reason why the number is different as it is for Enterprise Square, because it's Paladin and a third party provider that does it down there. My hope is that, you know what, there's a couple of things that are really important to remember. Everyone knows what 911 is. Remembering a couple of other numbers, even if it's one or two for the campus that you're on, I hope that that becomes a habit where people have that at their fingertips, because they can be, and, you know, unfortunately, may be involved in a stressful situation, and then fumbling around trying to Google something is, you know, seconds matter. So I guess my education and my push is that those numbers are worth knowing. How can we get that through to people that they actually have those at their fingertips or have them memorized?
Okay, thank you. Levi, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thanks for coming and give the presentation. I accumulated a handful of, I guess, questions and comments here. Do you want me to go through them all together or one at a time?
Absolutely. One at a time.
Okay. So under the slide that mentioned the building action plan, the measures will range from installation of bike cages and upgrading security infrastructure such as card reader technology, yep, to the cost-effective reduction of facility hours and points of entry. In that first piece there, the upgrading security infrastructure, for the hardware, there's still a lot of non-prox magstripe readers on campus.
Mm-hmm.
How many doors and readers are we expecting to upgrade? Is it going to be like all or some or most? What is the unit cost of each of those, and estimated total cost of what these upgrades are going to be, where the capital for these upgrades is going to come from?
Wow, good question.
And I am the money guy after all.
Well, you've probably heard me speak to that in a number of different forms, but I'll definitely give you an honest answer.
And I guess finally to that piece, are these readers, if we were to put them in fairly soon, are they going to be rendered obsolete if or when one card transitions to a digital solution?
Mm-hmm. All good questions. So we have a number of different systems on our campus. Some of them are pretty antiquated. What I would tell you is it would be astronomical to replace them all. A rolling plan with several million dollars a year, it is going to take us 15 to 20 years. So therefore, the answer is that's not possible. And we're into a triage system when things fail. We're replacing them, or where it is inexistent, we're seeking to put them. So one of the things that Michael and I have talked about is, you know, we have some primary corridors or you know, call them headways or spines throughout our campus that right now may not have card access. Those would be a focus for me. And unfortunately, we are actually cannibalizing systems as we're replacing to try and maintain our older systems. We can have an entirely different conversation around deferred maintenance and maintenance funding, because those are my purview as well. Mm-hmm. But that would take us a long time. So really, we're into triaging the absolute critical places for card access. Other examples would be building new bike cages. Mm-hmm. And they're not cheap either, so that we're encouraging people to act sustainably, but also be safe bringing their bikes on campus. And then we have members who enter our buildings and are living in our mechanical systems. And we've had examples where, you know, people got stuck. And the only reason we found them is because we sent mechanics to fix a leaking pipe and someone was moaning. So those are the areas that we are focused on. I'll call it making it much more difficult. And if we look to law, you know, we've been very purposeful in identifying those locations and then putting in a fencing so that people cannot access or steal things from buildings through the roof. Excuse my newfie accent. I say roof. It sounds like a dog, but I had to focus on that. So I don't know if that answers that very good question and complex mm-hmm. question, but you know, we have no funding for life cycle replacement, and I'm dependent on government capital maintenance and renewal dollars to address our entire deferred maintenance liability. Mm-hmm. And we are triaging only the most critical of aspects, and that does include card access when it fails.
Okay, now you mentioned...
Sorry, Levi, I just want to confirm. You said you have a list of questions. How?
And I'm always happy to take questions and respond in writing that could be disseminated to the group.
Uh,
Maybe we can take the next hardest one.
I think I'll have you ask one more and then we can loop back to you. Okay. I just want to ensure everyone has
okay,
a chance.
Yeah. Just,
to,
this one to does tie in. It's kind of a follow-up too.
Okay.
So many, you did mention some of the systems that do already exist. There are many prox readers already. And since about 2018, all new cards issued are prox.
Mm-hmm.
But the system is a bit disjointed given that we have multiple security systems like Protégé, Linel, Legacy.
Correct.
Is there any plan to unify these into a single solution? And something I didn't account for was when you mentioned the long time frame in upgrading a lot of these, there might be security systems out there that we might be switching to or haven't even been invented yet. So is that only going to make the problem worse?
Potentially. So that is a task that I've tasked my engineering team with. Because I am cognizant of the switch of the procs with the one card. And that's something that we're going to have to come up with a solution because I think that's inevitable. So ultimately, I'm always looking for an effective and efficient way to improve the gaps in those systems. Some of them can do facility code mode, some of them cannot. So it's an ongoing challenge and something that we're actually involved with.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to be? Yes, okay. Adrian, please go ahead.
Hi there. I'd just like to say thank you for the presentation on this. It was actually really informing. So I myself am from the Augustana campus, and I know that one of our major concerns that students actually bring up to us is, especially with our night classes, they feel really unsafe considering the fact that it is a small, like, while we are a smaller community out there, it's more of an open area.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we don't, like, we at Augustana don't have capacity to do like programs such as like Safe Walk here. And so I was just wondering if there was any kind of like plans to try and like help with that sort of security issue.
I'm not aware of that sentiment. So it's good that you're raising it here through our survey and through our protective services and third party provider. I've always believed that we had little to no perceptions of insecurity or challenges in Augustana. We certainly aren't seeing incidents, but I think that's something I'd like to dive into a little bit further. If we want to connect offline, that we can brainstorm it with Michael and see what can we do that's going to be meaningful, either from an education or awareness or a program perspective.
Okay, thank you. That actually brings us to the end of that 10-minute increment. Okay, I see Nathan and Levi. Is there any opposition to a further 10-minute extension? Okay, seeing none, we're so extended. I think I'm going to suggest that this is the last extension, also just given we're eating into our recess. But yes, Stephen, please go ahead.
Yes, I just have kind of communications related thoughts and what's going out to students. And the first point I was hoping to raise a little more specific, noting that some building access has been altered for specific locations. I'm also in the law faculty, so I have the experience in the law center. And so for, you know, these specific situations where we're altering access in certain buildings. I'm just wondering what students can expect when it comes to communicating those changes. Like, I think right now we've experienced just an email from the dean or someone in the faculty, mm-hmm. but I'm just wondering if the university has expectations on how this gets communicated more writ large. And then the other communications related thought, and it might be more engagement, I think what is being put out there is well balanced to an extent, but I just wonder, and this is so, it's so complicated, it's so fraught, but I just wonder if we're going to be doing stuff like these listing circles, or we're going to be doing these storytelling campaigns, is there not an opportunity to challenge folks in a way to help them understand, you know, you might not actually be unsafe, it might be a perception. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that
like,
is fraught.
I just think like I think you're articulating some of those points of like that, you know, there's vulnerable communities out there and they might not actually be creating that
sense of, or like they might not be creating danger, but people feel like they're dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so I think if there's effort being put out there to be doing listening circles or storytelling, like that's an opportunity to have a little bit more of a nuanced conversation around what it actually means to be safe on campus. So start with the specific, simple question and get to that really complicated one.
No, fantastic. And you know what? Our communications support, Jeff Clausen, is actually doubling down on a broader campaign. I had hoped that we would have already organized and landed on our building hours. That's a rather complex process where my facility service partners have to engage all of the faculties and users to make sure that we are addressing or meeting their needs. So we're still working through it, where I actually wanted those systems and communications in place. Our team is in the process of making sure we have aligned and informative signage going up on all the doors, as well as a presence on our website. So I'm hoping that not just through the dean or an email from the faculty general manager, but something more comprehensive that touches on it, because every building is different, as you've seen, because there are different needs. So really, it's not as polished as I would have hoped it would have been by the beginning of this academic year, but now we're committed to working through it as quickly as we can, with that acknowledgement up front that it's getting dark and it's getting cold, and we need to have done better. So that's that one. Perception of safety. That is one that I don't know if anyone knows my background or did any homework on me, but I'm a retired Army officer for 24 years. So my perception of safety is very different, given the experiences I've lived and the training I've received, than most other people. So I think it becomes fraught to engage and then convince someone that their perception of safety and security may be flawed or wrong. I do think there is a discussion to be had in what is perhaps considered to be acceptable, because there can be extremes of people's perceptions. And I think we need to be able to speak to those in a mindful way, and that our actions are appropriate. I would go back to, I'll tell you how I feel walking through the LRT. I'm 270 pounds and I'm a pretty fit and, you know, I'm a whatever. I'm not always feeling great, because you don't know. Some people are under the influence and they lose their judgment, and long-term substance abuse actually is a significant inhibitor to people's judgment, and violence is often the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds. So to suggest that it's not a potential danger situation, I think that would be a stretch. I do think we need to have people be empathetic, and that within their means, they're demonstrating courage, and that I'll use a bystander example. And I know that the city of Edmonton is engaging in bystander awareness, because we did have an incident in transit on the university not that long ago where one of our students was stabbed. And unfortunately, a lot of people were shocked and didn't know what to do. And hence, nothing was done. No one was called. So I think, you know, the ability to, again, call the right organization when something is happening, or act within your means without putting yourself in a dangerous situation, is something that we have work to do in getting as many people to that state as we can. Does that answer your question? Because it's an absolutely, you know, that question is complex.
I think it partially answers it. I think I would encourage continuing to rebalance that conversation and focusing on empathy as opposed to just safety is important. And looking at the data itself, like just grounding this in data, it is not a terrible story, at least based on this one survey. Like there's about 20% of students on North Campus, at least, that feel some level of danger at times. And so, you know, it's not like we have to communicate this, like, or challenge people's perceptions of safety. We don't have to challenge everybody's challenge of perception of safety. It might be more targeted and right. Yeah, but I should just be quiet. I'm sorry. I thank you for answering your question. No, I'm going on for too long.
I think it's a great question. I think perception is something that we need to work through. You know, I'd also just highlight that as it gets dark and as people move in the LRTs, that number of people feeling safe goes down considerably. You know, I think from recollection, 37% don't feel safe, which is a different reflection of what happens during the daytime. So there's work to be done. And certainly the more informed and more engaged our members are, we have a safety tips sheet that we'll also be distributing. And it's being aware of what can you do to maintain awareness in your surroundings where there could potentially be something that's going on. So you can act accordingly. You know, do you stare? Do you engage? Do you shout? You know, there's lots of things that people need to remind themselves not to instigate someone who could be dangerous, but absolutely is not unless provoked. So there's a lot of awareness and education that is required for our community. Again, one incident is too many. So that's my goal is to, that we don't have anyone injured or suffering an unnecessary trauma if we can just focus a little bit on individual and collective security. But, you know, everyone has a right to their thoughts and opinions. And I think yours is valid for a lot of our community.
Thank you. Jill, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you for your presentation. I also want to acknowledge Josh and Tracy and Janelle for being here. It's really important and for explaining kind of the work that you do. It's essential. So yeah, thank you. I come from Faculté Saint-Jean. Generally, I just want to, it's more of a statement, just kind of like the feeling of students at Campus Saint-Jean, like, is that they're more likely probably to call the police or a police officer than the UL Alberta Protective Services. Like last week we had an incident where somebody, it was like 9 p.m. and somebody tried crawling through our like office window, and we tried to call campus services, but it just because of the distance, like people are worried about people not getting there fast enough. Like I'm not sure if there's like advice or that students at Campus Saint-Jean like should feel like they're going to still get the same sort of like attention or services delivered quickly, or if there's any sort of solutions there. It's kind of similar to the question about Augustana. So if this is a further conversation, then just let me know.
No, absolutely. You know, the protective services team does patrol in that area, and it really it's intelligence driven, the number of incidents that happen. But a stranger crawling through someone's window, that's quite alarming. You know, it depends. Is that person or that student like feel like their life is in danger? 911 is the absolute right number to call. However, I would suggest that protective services needs to be called because, again, they can't act if they don't know. I had someone take a picture of the protective services team stopping off at 3 o'clock in the morning for a coffee. Because they were on their way back from patrolling in Campus Asia. And then, what were they doing over there? And I said, it's one of our campuses. So funny enough, your dean is my fellow co-chair on the Safety and Security Committee. I wish he was here, Jason Carey. And I love his contribution and his presence. But that's definitely something I'll take up with him, because I think he's probably an even more powerful advocate than I am, because I kind of look like an Army guy or a police guy, where Jason does not, but we speak the same language, just in a different way.
Okay, thank you. Nathan, please go ahead.
Thank you. Art students, particularly fine art students who are impacted by increases in trespassing suspicious activities in the fine arts building, are impacted by such security concerns. Can you comment on passive and active security measures on campus, specifically in the fine arts building and housing union building?
Absolutely. You know, I think the fine arts building was how the campus and facility safety security working group got started in 2019. And I was part of those town halls. So I would suggest it has the exact same measures as all of our other buildings. And it's my facility service partner who works with the faculty leadership or the student groups, the general manager, to make sure that we are taking the appropriate measures around if there's infrastructure improvements required to articulate what are those. And as Michael would testify, you know, we have a standing matrix where people can populate infrastructure issues or security issues so they can be triaged appropriately. And whether that's with a reduction in hours, building infrastructure, or focused UAPS patrols, that's all being done the same in fine arts as it would be in ECA or in HUB. But I do acknowledge that some of those are higher incident, as we point out in our incident map. And my director of protective services is in the midst of hiring a third-party security provider, because that way we have a guaranteed presence, at least for a period of 6 months from October to March, where we intend to have actually fixed locations at what we're referring to as primary entrances, where they can act both as eyes and ears to things that are going wrong, and a visible security presence, and also a way to engage our community with distributing communications and marketing material.
Okay, thank you. That does bring us to the end of that 10-minute extension, and I would suggest we move into recess. We do have a few motions to consider later on in the meeting, but if there is a motion to extend, we can entertain it. Okay, moved by Nathan, seconded Levi. Is there any opposition to a further extension? If there is, we'll take a vote on this one. Opposition? Sure.
Just for folks as well, we can also follow up after the meeting. James will also, or James's team will also be coming to both Cora and COFA too, so there would be more FaceTime. And like I said, I can brief you or get you in contact with James and his team too.
Okay. With that being said, is there still a desire to extend? Yes. Yes. Okay. So any opposition to a further 10-minute extension? Yes, we can vote. Okay. So the extension requires a 2/3 majority to succeed. All those in favor of extending for a further 10 minutes, please raise your hands. Okay, thank you. Please lower. All those opposed. Is that a hand? Okay. Okay, thank you very much. With 5 in favor and 8 opposed, that motion fails. Thank you so much to the University of Alberta Safety and Security Committee for coming to present. It's been wonderful hearing about the experiences and the program. So round of applause. And yes, as Michael said, there are more opportunities to give feedback. I think just reach out to Michael if you would like to do so. So with that, we'll move to recess. But before we do so, I'll take attendance. Hey, Christian Fotang, Pedro Almeida.
Here.
Chris Beasley. Levi Flamin.
Here.
Michael Griffiths.
Here.
Stephen Rates.
Here.
Adrian Lamb.
Here.
Mason Peach. Nathan Teason.
Here.
Muniba Kadir.
Here.
Ayman Saif. Amir Mohammed.
Here.
Damon Atwood.
Here.
El Malahi.
Here.
Precious Majekodumni. Jillian Eisenstadt.
Here.
Noor Abdelwahab.
Here.
Laurel Ford.
Here.
Megan Garbutt.
Here.
And I am present, and we will check if the resource or the non-voting members are still in attendance. So with that, we will move into recess, and we will resume at 8:02 p.m. Okay, Council, welcome back. It is 8:03 p.m. Oh, wow, that got quiet really quick. So welcome back from recess. On to the rest of our agenda, starting with reports. Do we have oral reports from execs today? Okay, starting with student life, Michael, please go ahead.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So I just wanted to draw attention to two quick things in the SL portfolio. First of all, thank you so much to all of the student reps and associations that participated in our Campus Clash event last Friday. Absolutely wonderful attendance. Those of you who were there would know that the student section was quite populated. So that is great. We had approximately 27,000 students overall across the five schools that were there. And of those, nearly 1,200 were U of A students. So of five schools, that's very good. We were by far the best school in attendance. For our faculty associations that this event was a fundraiser for, you will be getting your checks in a little bit. I am working on that. We'll take care of all the logistics, but I just want to say a huge shout out to the success of that event, and better luck next time for the Elks to actually win the game. And the second thing is this Thursday at 1 p.m. on Main Quad will be the 2023 Residential School Memorial. I would really encourage folks to check this out. I will drop a link to the program for the memorial in our students council chat. I also have posters with me that I will hand out after, or encourage folks to come grab. I would love for you to take this back, post it somewhere in the buildings you frequent, or share it with folks in your networks and your communities. We would really love to have great attendance for that event on Thursday, and it's a very important cause. The Students Union has planned this with the Indigenous Students Union, and we'll have several speakers that will be very impactful. So wanted to draw attention to those. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Levi, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Not a whole lot to report other than what was on the written, but I did also want to second what Michael said about Campus Clash. I was also there in attendance, both to watch our president flip the coin, which he didn't do, and to watch the Elks beat BC, which they also didn't do. But it was still a great, fantastic experience overall. Like Michael said, we were the school with the highest attendance. So it's great to see campus coming out, especially on a night when the Bears were playing on South Campus too. So it's given the interest in events like this and the campus spirit and the intercollegiality between the different schools, I'm hoping that we can continue this with the Elks in future years and potentially approach some of the other local sports teams as well, whether it be the Oilers or the baseball team.
Thank you. Chris, please go ahead.
Due to human error, you won't find my report in the package. I was the human that erred there. But I've been advised by Courtney to ask if the governance staff could minute this auditory report, and I'll write up a full written report, submit that in with next council agenda, so there's a written record for it as well. Last few weeks, last Tuesday, I was on 6:30 CHED to talk about student affordability. As well, last Thursday, September 21st, I was able to speak at the Camrose Transit Advisory Committee, along with the president of the Augustana Students Association. And generally, I helped the Augustana Students Association last Thursday meet with two city councilors, the city manager, and the mayor of Camrose to further some discussions about how we can get the Lifeline Shuttle or Camrose Connector back to Camrose. Also attended a Senate meeting out in Camrose, and then that Senate meeting continued onto the Friday as well. During the first week of school as well, I had the chance to meet with a member of parliament, Hedy Fry, who's the chair of the Federal Standing Committee on Canadian Heritage. And so we were able to talk about the importance of the Educational Fair Dealing Clause within the Canadian Copyright Act, which helps keep textbook costs low for students all across Canada. Beyond this as well, I participated in CASA's September e-plenary, where we approved a number of CASA policies, took a look at the CASA budget and approved our campaign for this year, as well as approving Wasima Juman, who you've all met, as the next executive director of CASA. Finally, finally, as well, on Thursday, so in 2 days from now, the Minister of Advanced Education will be here on campus, touring the U of A campus. And so myself and President Fo Tang have been preparing for that, along with the University of Alberta Graduate Students Association as well, and some of the external relations staff at the University of Alberta. But thank you all. Happy to answer questions, as always.
Thank you. And Pedro, please go ahead.
Most of what I've been up to, or the big items I've been up to, can be found in the written report. I would just add that over the past few little bit, we've been talking a lot with the Council of Faculty Associations about the Clean Air Strategy, which is a proposal that is coming to GFC on October 16th. The COFA Senior Board approved a motion to release a joint statement in support of the Indigenous Students Union's Clean Air Strategy response letter. That statement has been issued and signed by 12 of the faculty associations, and has been included as part of an overall package that has been sent to the governance team to be included with the GFC materials on October 16th. Alongside some survey data that we received back on the usage of on the rate of proportion on whatever the word is, please minute. I just English is my second language. On the proportion of vaping smoking on campus and with our students. I would highly encourage any and all members to attend that meeting on October 16th of GFC, to bring students to attend that meeting on October 16th. Having the student there in person can really make a difference in how the faculty votes. GFC is made up of 158 members, the around a third of which are students, undergraduate and graduate, and the next biggest group is the faculty. So if the Clean Air Strategy proposal will be heavily dependent on the student vote and the faculty vote, and it's been suggested to us that if GFC does not pass the Clean Air Strategy, the board also will not. So with all of that in mind, please reach out if you have any questions. That's the only last thing that has been in recent development since the report was submitted.
Thank you. Christian, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Hi, Council. Everything that I have to update is written in the written report. So I just wanted to provide that and also to add some context to what Michael and Levi also mentioned before. I, too, participated in campus clash. It was exciting to see all the U of A students there and a bit of feedback for the event organizers or future VPSLs who might participate in the event is when they invite the SU presidents to come flip the coin, they should either make it that the school that had the highest participating amount of students from their respective university be the one to flip the coin, or at least, you know, just not make me cry as I watched the coin get flipped. But it was awesome to be on the center field with the refs and the players. And hopefully, if it happens next time, I really do hope it does, that you can all show up there and we can still bring on the spirit cheer and campus cheer. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, executives, for your oral reports. Do we have any reports from boards or committees? Any board or committee reports? Any reports from the general membership? Okay, seeing none, we'll move into open forum. Are there any guests of council wishing to make statements or ask questions at today's meeting? Yes, and if you could please just state whether it's a question or a statement, and maybe just reintroduce yourself.
Hi, I'm a Parajita, staff reporter at the Gateway, and I'd like to direct this question towards VP Academic Pedro Almeida. How do you plan on defining mild versus extreme cases of academic dishonesty, and who would be involved in that process?
I think that as the academic integrity policy is fine-tuned over the next little bit, that's one of the most important questions, is the definitions of different types of academic misconduct. And I think it also goes back to Damon's question from earlier that touched on how would the student conduct office provide, let's say, a template of what sanctions is indicated for each type of conduct. Now, the risk that we run into that, and with all these specific definitions, and Chris specified this, but I don't know if he was able to get into the full depth of it, is that you eventually can lead to a system in which students are over penalized for sanction for misconduct that they wouldn't otherwise been, because it would have been treated with non-adjudicative or non-disciplinary accountability options as outlined in the policy. So what we are trying to do is really take it as a student-centered approach, a student unique student approach, to not treat every student as if every student has undergone the same experience and undergone and come from the same cultural context, but instead to really focus in on what is the context for that specific case at that specific time, and that'll vary a lot. One thing that the new policy does outline that I think is important, with understanding the difference between mild and other more severe types of conduct, is that any instance in which a severe sanction is wanting to be imposed by the faculty decision maker, that decision then has to be passed on to the student conduct officer, I believe, which means that there's a second set of eyes on it to ensure that any of these like larger decisions that can really impact students over time, especially, are done with carefulness to the process, and carefulness to ensure that students aren't being over punished. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. If there's new context, yeah. Sure. Okay.
Yeah, I guess there's like part of the question was just like how we plan to get some student feedback as well. And I know Pedro's been really working hard, and Chris acknowledged it, just how passionate Pedro's brought a lot of student perspectives already to the table. Some of the concerns around campus, St. John, all that are from conversations that Pedro's had with the Faculty Association presidents. And this topic has come to other platforms such as Council of Student Affairs on GFC. I anticipate that it was also going to come to GFC for a final approval.
Yes.
So that's other avenues. So with that, we're always going to be like reaching out to students and with the students who sit on Council of Student Affairs, encouraging them as well to get feedback when the policy comes back for some discussion and review again. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further statements or questions from guests of council today? Seeing none, we will move out of open forum and into question period. Do any members of council have statements or questions for other members? Okay, seeing none, that brings us to the end of question period. We have no unfinished business, so we'll move into board and committee business. The first item is to nominate three members of Students' Council to the Physical Activity and Wellness Center Strategic Operating Committee, or POSOC. Michael, would you like to introduce that motion?
Sure, I'll just keep it quick, folks. We nominated Councillor Ford to this board already, and Levi will be serving on behalf as the President's Delegate on this committee, so we actually have three more spots, which is quite a few. So we're hoping to get members of council. If not, we will send that to a student at large selection. But POSOC is the board of directors, like Christian mentioned, for the Physical Activity and Wellness Center. So you are just conducting high level oversight of the center and like offering strategic direction and helping shape that for the center and the staff that administer that. I believe there are four meetings this year, one scheduled in October, and then bi-monthly throughout the rest of the year. So, yeah.
Thank you. Before we go into nominations, maybe do you have the meeting schedule just off the top of your heads, Levi?
October 2nd, December 4th, February 5th, and April 8th, all from 3 to 4 p.m.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions regarding this particular nomination? Okay, seeing none at this time, I would welcome nominations from the floor. Just a reminder that you cannot self-nominate, but please continue using hand signals or messaging to ask for nominations. With that being said, are there any nominations from the floor? Nathan.
I would like to nominate the Honorable Counselor Amir.
Accepted.
Okay, thank you. Any further nominations from the floor? Christian.
I was having a fascinating conversation where he was telling me just how much free time he has. So as I looked at nominate Counselor Atwood.
Declined.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Any further nominations from the floor? Perhaps to ease some of the tension, it does sound like we can fill the remaining positions with students at large too. Am I correct in that understanding? Yeah, okay. Any further nominations? Pedro?
I would like to nominate Vice President Griffiths.
Michael?
Sure.
Michael accepts. So that is 2 of 3 seats. Any further nominations from the floor? Last call for nominations for the Physical Activity and Wellness Strategic Operating Committee. Okay. Given that we have fewer nominees than seats available, is there any opposition to declaring those 2 seats acclaimed without any sort of speeches or voting? Any opposition to that? Okay, seeing none, Amir Mohammed and Michael Griffiths are appointed to POSOC via acclamation. Congratulations. I would also look favorably upon a motion to refer the remaining seat to a committee for to fill it with a student at large. Michael, to that effect. Okay. And I see Amir seconds. Here, I can type that out, Courtney. Council Administration Committee, would that be appropriate? Okay, thank you. So the motion is to refer the item to the Council Administration Committee to fill the remaining vacancy with a student at large. Are there any questions or comments about kind of that process? I don't believe this will be contentious. Okay, seeing no questions or comments, I think we can take this by unanimous consent. I don't think anyone will oppose this. So is there any objection to referring the item to Council Administration Committee for the appointment of a student at large? Any objection? Okay, seeing none, the motion is carried and the item is referred to the Council Administration Committee for the appointment of a student at large. Thank you, everybody. And we will move to our next item, which is the motion to amend the 2023-24 council meeting schedule by rescheduling the October 14 meeting back to its original date of October 10th. Adrian, would you like to introduce?
Yes. First of all, I'd like to make a friendly amendment to this motion and actually reschedule the October 14 meeting to October 15th.
Okay. Would you like to provide maybe some context just around why?
So originally, as you all know, we originally scheduled the August Center Retreat Day for October 14th. However, the university decided to hold open house on that exact day as well. When I put this motion into the order papers, we originally were just going to move it back to the original date. However, thanks to some last minute calls and pleading on my end to the my SRA president, we were able to confirm a date of October 15th at, instead, which is why I am bringing forward this amendment.
Okay. I think before we pass this amendment, just because it's given with fairly short notice and the 15th is a Sunday, maybe just a quick straw poll of the room of like, can you raise your hand if you think you'd be able to make that retreat date? If you could just raise your hand if you would be able to. It seems like a fairly mixed response. So what I'm going to say is like, we can proceed with changing it to the 15th. That is a possibility. We can also continue to look at further dates. Does anyone in the room kind of have thoughts on that proposition? Pedro?
I think that it's super, super important that we go out to Augustana and talk to the Augustana Student Association, the Augustana students. Having said that, though, it's also really important that we do it at a time when a lot of us are able to engage in that conversation. And if that means delaying the conversation, the time in which we go out to Augustana, that may be a more appropriate course of action to show our respect to the Augustana students and the Augustana Student Association, as opposed to trying to schedule in a last minute change. Even though I'm incredibly appreciative of Adrian's efforts in coming up with the solution, but just given the short period of time, which makes Adrian's efforts even more impressive, it does pose that risk of it is worse if we schedule something that is sooner and a minority of us attends than if we go to schedule something a little bit later into the academic year. But yeah.
Thank you. The other thing I do just want to note, and the reason I'm being particularly cautious, is since we're grouping the council meeting with the retreat, it could affect attendance if we choose a date where a lot of people aren't available. So I just want to ensure there's kind of fairness to members and don't want to affect anyone's attendance in a negative way. But with that being said, are there further thoughts from the room? I'm not for or opposed either option. I just want to kind of give the opportunity of conversation. Are there any other thoughts? Damon?
If I understand correctly, the 14th isn't an option now anyways, right?
Yeah, so this would be switching it either to the 15th or back to the original date of the 10th.
And is the 10th still an option or no? I thought it wasn't because SRA didn't want to do that.
So the 10th would just be the normal council meeting. It wouldn't be the retreat.
I mean, just to me, it makes sense to just move it to the 15th. And if an issue arises to change the date that people want to argue about more in the future, not argue, but discuss more in the future, we just deal with it then. At least then we'll have a date.
The 15th would, like, this would be our next council meeting too, I believe. Mm. Yeah, so it's kind of a decision we make now and would be difficult to change again, I suppose, is the other factor. Any other thoughts on a decision? Stephen?
Just briefly, if the council meeting is going to be wedged into this overall experience and we're not available for the full day, like, it, will there be an opportunity to participate remote for the council meeting? Because that'll buoy attendance if some people have, I already have scheduled commitments during the day, but might be able to make the council meeting if it's at a specific point.
Yeah. So that's a great question. With the retreats, we absolutely kind of having a hybrid environment is a minimum. So people will have the opportunity to call in. Just to note, though, that the meeting time within the retreat is closer, I think it's around 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
I would just say that I think I'd support the 15th to at least have a date set for us to go to Augustana in the shorter term. And if it doesn't pan out going out there, then we still have a council date set as well. And we're not bailing on one to just get surety on the other.
Okay.
That's my personal opinion, though. Anybody can vote any way they want.
Yes.
So to clarify, if the meeting is moved to the 10th, the Augustana retreat on the 15th or 14th is scratched for the moment, and it's looked at it for a later date altogether.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Sounds good. That was the question. That's all I asked to ask.
Okay. Any other thoughts on how to proceed? Okay. I think maybe we'll vote on an amendment to make it the 15th to see if there's desire for that. And then if not, we'll consider moving it back to the 10th if the 15th is deemed to be a poor option. So the motion is to amend the motion to schedule the retreat on the 15th. Moved by Adrian. Could I please get a second? I see Amir. Just before we move into a vote, is there any other questions? Meg, do you have anything? Yeah.
Just wondering, I know you said if we decide it's better on the 10th, but when would we decide that? Because this is the next council meeting.
Yeah, so first we'll vote on moving it to the 15th. If that fails, then we'll vote on moving it to the 10th.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions before voting? Okay, seeing none, we'll move into a vote on the motion to amend the item to schedule the date of the retreat to October 15th. This requires a simple majority to pass. If you're in favor of having a retreat on October 15th, please make it known by a show of hands or placards. Those in favor. That's a good question, and it's a good correction. It's actually just amending. So if you're in favor of amending the motion to read October 15th, those in favor. Okay, thank you. Please lower. Those opposed to amending the motion to read October 15th, those opposed. Okay, thank you. Please lower. With 13 in favor and one opposed, the motion is amended to read October 15th. And the motion now before council is to amend the meeting schedule, so actually change the date, by rescheduling the October 14th meeting to October 15th. Is there any further debate before we go into a vote on this? Michael.
Can we just have another confident, semi-confident show of hands in who would be able to make the full retreat and not just the meeting?
Okay. Who would be able to make the full retreat?
Is it it's just one, how long? I don't know any details about the retreat. How long is it?
It would be about 9:30 to 6 or 7.
So working a shift.
It's it's a whole day kind of event.
Okay.
Yes, Meg.
What if we're partially short? Because I don't have my work schedule and I asked for the other day off. So I'll put my hand halfway up. Okay.
Stephen?
We're getting pretty deep into the meeting here. We can just vote on if it occurs on the 15th. If the retreat doesn't occur, we have the council meeting on this date for a shortened period of time. Instead of flummoxing back and forth between 10th, 15th, 14th. We could just make a decision now. Or I see Courtney's got a good point.
Oh, my point is I totally agree with you. The only thing I just want to say for consideration is if for some reason we can't do the retreat on the 15th, I'm going to say, depending on when we know we can't do it, that council meeting on Sunday may be entirely virtual because I don't know if I could get this room in time. So that's just a consideration. Just if we're going to do it and we don't do the retreat, that council meeting might just be virtual. That was the only thing I just wanted to kind of pop in and say.
Okay. So I think we've settled on seeing if the 15th sticks and holding the meeting virtually then anyways. Was there any other statements or questions before we move into a vote, Pedro?
I just think it's important for us to figure out if we are able to attend the retreat or not, because that completely changes whether it's appropriate for us to have, like, to plan it and communicate it with Augustana and pass this motion. And also, I would say that we tend to have a general, like, standing orders in our systems in place to get provide counselors as many, like, business days as possible and really make it a part of, like, not overextending your availability in the weekend as counselors. And so, again, if we're not going to be able to attend the retreat, I really think it's imperative that we're able to know that before we change the meeting. So I appreciate the comp. We're running a little bit close to the end. But like it's really imperative that in communicating with Augustana, we have the information so that we don't, I think it would be disrespectful to Augustana and to the Augustana students if we change something and accommodate in all these ways, and then when the day shows up, it's only four of us there or five of us in person. And that kind of relies on the meeting as well.
So this is just my advice. You feel free to take it or leave it. But at this point, I think I would recommend just moving the meeting back to the 10th. To be honest, like, the retreat has a fair amount of moving parts, as Pedro's kind of alluded to, and doing the decision this way feels a little rushed and haphazard. Again, it is entirely up to you all as a group. We can always reschedule the retreat to occur another time in a matter that is more prepared. Levi, please go ahead.
I just want to second what the speaker said. That's why I was against the motion to amend, not because I was against the idea of having it, but with only 2.5 weeks, like, we just passed that amendment and there's still lingering questions. Like, that should have been settled, and clearly it's not. If there's any instance where not everybody on council can go, we don't want to spend the several hundred or several thousand dollars it costs to rent a bus to go down there for five people. It wouldn't be the first time it's happened. And I know that at least this year, there are a couple people who are just as keen about, like, fiscal responsibility and stuff as I am. And that's very much not when the average cost of renting that bus is spread out over so few people. So we're not saying we're not going to have it, but I think this should be put off until later in the year when we can have everything. We're not scrambling kind of at the last minute to make things work.
Okay, thank you. Meg, please go ahead.
I kind of agree as well. Like, personally, I'd like knowing a date so I can make sure that I can come. But that's just me. I don't know how everyone else feels, but it'd be nice to ask for it off of work and, like, make sure I can be there. But
if you feel like I'm wrong, please tell me. But, and not directed specifically to you, I worry about giving my opinion sometimes because I don't want to scare people off.
No, I was agreeing with you. Like, I agree. Yeah. But
Chris, please go ahead.
I also want to note there's always just, like, a degree of survivorship bias at play, in the sense that, like, it's those of us who were able to make today's meeting, deciding what works well for us, knowing that, like, there are a lot of counselors who aren't here, who would also, like, probably appreciate the ability of being asked of whether or not the Sunday works for them. We could do some kind of a poll online and an e-vote, but it may be better to just postpone entirely. Happy to go with what the group decides, though.
Jill, please.
Yeah, we're getting pretty in the weeds here, but I agree with the moving it back to October 10th. I know that Augustana really wanted to have theirs early, but just it's unfortunate that open house happened on the same day. And I know a lot of us are actually working open house just because a lot of us are, like, you know, ambassadors or whatever it may be. So having it for the day after, like, it kind of extends ourselves as counselors, like, a little bit. I'll be a little stretched thin that weekend. So, like, I would prefer if we were to move it somewhere else.
Okay. Any kind of last statements before we make a decision? Okay. Before we kind of do the decision-making process, I just want to, again, thank Adrian and ASA for kind of coming up with an alternative at breakneck speed, like that's impressive. But yeah, I think just given the concern in the room, it may be wise to just reset it to October 10th. So basically, I'll just look for a motion to that effect to change it back. Nathan and Amir, mover seconder. So the motion will be... Just because we voted on the amendment already. It's just small things. I can still have words out there and think we're good. Levi. I was gonna treat it more as just like suspending the rules. It kind of avoids the particularities of reconsider. Yeah. So the motion is basically to just move the retreat back to October 10th. We'll move into a vote on this. This just, again, changes the wording, and then we'll actually vote on changing the date back. So if you are in favor of changing the wording back to October 10th, please make it known by a show of hands. Those in favor. Okay, thank you. Please lower. Okay, and those opposed? Okay, thank you. So with 13 in favor and 1 opposed, the wording of the motion is changed back to October 10th. We'll now just move straight into a vote on actually changing the date. So the motion is to amend the 2023-24 council meeting schedule by rescheduling the October 14th meeting to October 10th. All those in favor, please make it known by a show of hands. Okay, please lower. All those opposed. Okay, thank you. With 13 in favor and 1 opposed, the motion is carried. And the October 14th meeting is rescheduled back to October 10th. Thank you for bearing with us. I know that was a little confusing, but now we'll move to our final item of board and committee business, which is the motion to appoint one student counselor to sit on the UASU Strategic Plan Steering Committee. Christian, would you like to introduce this motion?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. So, Council, I talked about this, I believe, maybe in an earlier Council reports, but I believe you also touched on this at GovCamp. Maybe if we didn't, I'm doing it now. But as it happens, organizations like ourselves have strategic plans that help guide and give a direction as to where we're trying to go within the next 5 years, what we're trying to improve, what we're trying to achieve. And oftentimes with that come metrics for some of the goals that we've set for ourselves. And this year, we will be working on renewing the UAS strategic plan, which is set to expire. So it'll fall upon the steering committee to work on creating a new strategic plan that I believe will last us either 4 or 5 years. Is it usually 5 years, Levi? I think the last one was 2019 to 2024. So anyway, you will get all those details when you get there. But under the membership requirements of the steering committee, we're searching for one counselor who has the time, availability, and interest to sit on this committee. What your role will look like will be working on the committee to guide engagement discussion, consultation discussions with our staff, with students, with our volunteers, talking about some, what are those goals and metrics would look like? What are some of the things we should touch on? Do we need to, or should we revisit things like our mission, vision, and value statements? Yeah, so that's what it could look like. The time commitment, I haven't been as specific about that, and I apologize because we're still trying to get everyone together to meet, but I don't anticipate that maybe the fall semester will probably be the crunch time, but then as we get closer to the winter, when hopefully we can have the plan finished and launched by March or April, things would have reduced a bit, but I'm happy to answer any other following questions. So if you're really eager to get involved in things like strategic planning, it looks great for when you know you're going to other sorts of initiatives in the future or work to have that experience in your pocket. So happy to chat more about that. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to confirm, the meeting schedule will be set by the committee once it's formed. Okay. Before we move into nominations, are there any questions about the appointment or the committee or the strategic plan? Okay, seeing none, we'll move into nominations from the floor. Are there any nominations? This is a very important committee. Christian kind of alluded to it, but since kind of our elected officials turn over year to year, this committee provides kind of multi-year direction in a way that other things don't always. I see Meg, please go ahead.
I would like to nominate Adrian.
Adrian?
I accept.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further nominations from the floor? Last call for nominations for the Strategic Plan Steering Committee. Last call. Sorry. Yes.
Just a quick point of information. The committee also has 5 student at large positions, and counselors would technically qualify for student at large positions as well. Or like any student qualifies for student at large positions. So keep that in mind as well. The application process is different. But yeah, I don't know if that is a point of information, but
we'll take it. Any further nominations from the floor? Okay, seeing none, since there's only one nominee and one available position, is there any opposition to declaring Adrian Lam appointed via acclamation? Any opposition? Okay, seeing none, Adrian Lam is declared appointed via acclamation. Congratulations. Okay. So that brings us to the end of board and committee business. We have no general orders. We do have an item on closed session today. So I will explain kind of the procedure for this, but for the time being, I would ask guests to exit the chambers and the Zoom call. If we could just confirm. Thank you. Thank you, Gateway, for bearing with us. Yes. It does, but it's a rationale is given before we vote. And the rationale is given in closed. Okay, so we are now in closed session. Just a reminder that the rules of confidentiality apply. So the way this works is the motion was moved and seconded. So that brings it into a sort of preliminary stage where the mover gives a rationale explaining why it should be in closed session. After that, council votes whether to hear it in closed session, just to balance sensitive information and transparency to the student body. So with that, Pedro, I'll ask you to give an introduction.
Sure. Do I need a seconder before I give the introduction? Or
yes. Uniquely, this requires 2 seconders. So I'd look for